I said to myself, well, I've got AIDS. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. To get upset and depressed about it is probably the worst thing that you can do. I mean, there's the rest of your life to live. To go around thinking, oh my goodness, I've got this terrible disease.
I'm not frightened of dying anyway. I'm just frightened of becoming incapable, incontinent, unable to make intelligent decisions. That frightens me very much, but I'm not frightened of dying as such.
The doctors confirmed that I had AIDS was, in some respects, a nothing feeling that I already knew, in a sense. They just confirmed what I already knew. I was just frightened.
Recently, I was very scared when I was in hospital. The fear did hit me, and you're sort of, I can't put my finger on it. It must be just afraid of the unknown, afraid that I was dying.
The shared experiences of these courageous men confronting their HIV/AIDS diagnosis provided a raw portrayal of their struggles. Once silenced by stigma from the British press, they articulated profound challenges in managing the health, the stigma, and battling the government's indifferent response. As beacons of resilience, they highlighted the urgent need for awareness and support while navigating misinformation and societal bias. Their willingness to speak out on television in the 1980s illuminated the toll of stigma, urging collective responsibility in addressing the epidemic's medical and social implications. Join me as we hear their stories, in their voices, in their own words.
AIDS brings a response Fight from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS, The Lost Voices, with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it.
In December 1984, there were three men residing on Bristol's Ham Green Hospital's AIDS isolation ward and had been for many months, including Christmas of 1984. They were 28-year-old Alid Richards, 33-year-old Adam Shotko, and 40-year-old John Lewis. Thomas James Alid Richards sadly passed away at Ham Green on Tuesday the 29th of January 1985, aged only 28 years old. 2 days later, the Western Daily Press, the local newspaper, report the story under the headline, West, Gay Plague Death Number 3, and the article reads, a 28-year-old homosexual has died in Bristol's Ham Green Hospital after contracting the killer disease, AIDS. The man, from Bristol, was one of three homosexuals being treated in the hospital's infectious disease unit. None of them have been named, although retrospectively we know them to be Alid here, John Lewis and Adam Shotko. The Bristol man, who died on Tuesday evening, has been seriously ill with skin cancer for some time. He was first admitted to Ham Green Hospital in September. Yesterday, South West Regional Health Authority spokesman Noels Michael said the man had been home several times since then, but was readmitted last week. The two other AIDS victims, one aged 33, who we know to be Adam Shotko, and the other 40, we know to be John Lewis, both from Bath, well, John was based in London and originally from Canada, but you know, it's the press, are said to be fairly stable. However, 5 days later, John Lewis sadly passed away on Sunday the 3rd of February 1985, aged 40 years old. And in serving 15 of AIDS Lost Voices, we covered the story of John Lewis with those that knew him best. And at the time of John Lewis passing away at Ham Green Hospital, Thames TV are already on the isolation ward, recording for a documentary for their TV series called TVI, the episode titled AIDS, The Victims. Now, out of all the pseudonym names Adam or his clinician Dr. Glover could have chosen, I can't help but feel this was either Adam or Dr. Glover giving a nod to John Lewis, given they spent so much time on the isolation ward together and John Lewis had passed away only days prior. Now, in this interview, Adam is referred to as John. So let's take a listen.
John, who doesn't want to be identified, is still in hospital.
The disease is not leprosy, as it was. Society had the problem then, it's not contractable unless you're intimate with somebody or they take your blood in some way.
Do you feel like a leper?
I don't know yet. I'll know when I get out into society. And I said to myself, well, I've got AIDS. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. to get upset and depressed about it is probably the worst thing that you can do. I mean, there's the rest of your life to live. And to go around thinking, oh my goodness, I've got this terrible disease, which isn't that terrible, except it is terminal in most cases. It's going to be a battle, but I'm prepared to take it. Life is a battle. And this is just one I'm going to have to try and overcome. Which I'm looking forward to, incidentally.
Good afternoon, John.
Hello, Doctor.
And how are you feeling this afternoon?
Feeling fine, thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. I wonder if I might be allowed, John, to examine your glands. Have you noticed any pain or discomfort or swelling in this area recently, John?
None at all.
That's great. No discomfort there?
No.
Good.
John used to weigh 13 stone. Today, he's down to 9.5.
That's excellent. I can't feel a thing, John. No mischief afoot there?
No.
Dr. Glover is checking to see if John has any new illnesses because he's got AIDS. In this case, swollen glands.
No.
And on the other side now, another deep breath in. Well done.
And out. He's already had pneumonia, TB of the lower bowel, and a wasting illness. John got AIDS through homosexual contact in America. It is the promiscuous nature of parts of the gay community which has helped spread the disease across the world.
Excellent.
Living in a very large city, it becomes a very lonely life. And I found that being or getting affection from anybody really was important, and I found I got a lot of affection from men, and so I think obviously that I contracted the disease through for that reason.
I mean, do you think life has played a rather dirty trick on you in that
respect? No, not at all. No. I have regrets of having the disease, obviously. But there is no regrets, really. I think socially, my family that are out with the public are afraid that people might know that I've got it, which I think is extremely unfair, because I don't see why they should have this feeling of embarrassment. But it's not until the general public, I feel, are educated, it's not until then I feel that there will be prejudice.
Oh, incredibly moving words there from Adam. And I think you can hear in Adam's voice, he's trying to be optimistic. You know, he's not feeling sorry for himself, but I can't help but feel in that there is an undertone there that he knows he's looking death in the face. And it must have been awful. And I can't imagine, and I suspect you can't imagine either, how that must have felt for a 33-year-old man that's got his whole life ahead of him. It's truly heart-wrenching. And Adam's appearance on TVI aired on ITV on the 28th of February 1985 at 9:30 in the evening. And a few weeks after TVI aired, Adam left his room on the Ham Green AIDS isolation ward, where the Western Daily on the 23rd of March 1985 ran the headline, AIDS victim, age 33, goes home. And the article reads, a 33-year-old Bath man suffering from the killer disease AIDS has been released from Ham Green Hospital near Bristol. The man, who has not been named, has been sent home after nearly 3 months in hospital. The AIDS virus attacked the man's immune system and he contracted TB, but doctors are happy for him to stay at home while the TB is dormant. He was one of three victims being treated at Ham Green over Christmas. The other two men have since died. This is Alid Richards and John Lewis. Then, a little over 4 weeks, on the 29th of April 1985, on the front page of Bristol's Evening Post, they ran the headline, AIDS man number 4 dies in hospital. A fourth man has died of AIDS at Ham Green Hospital near Bristol. Mr. Adam Shotko, age 33, had been a patient in the hospital's isolation unit since before Christmas. He is understood to have come from Bath and to have contracted AIDS while living in America. Now, in relation to the article, Adam had sadly passed away the day prior on the 28th of April 1985. And despite Adam wishing not to be identified when giving his account of his reality to TVI and used the pseudonym John, I was able to confirm this to be Adam Shotko as I was privy to the production notes from Thames TV and further. Adam's mother Barbara and one of his brothers spoke about Adam's AIDS diagnosis in a follow-up special of TVI, the episode titled AIDS and You, which aired on ITV on the 7th of October 1985.
On a mother's mantelpiece, a memory of her son. He was homosexual. He had the disease AIDS.
The disease is not leprosy, as it would. Society had the problem then. It's not contractable unless you're intimate with somebody or they take your blood in some way.
Do you feel like a leper?
I don't know yet. I'll know when I get out into society.
Adam Shotko did not return to society. He went blind and died. AIDS had destroyed his immune system. Other diseases then swept through his body. His brother remembers.
I said to Adam, you've got to tell Mother. And I went downstairs and I said, Mum, Adam's got to talk to you. And then Adam told Mother about the quite depressing at the time. Mother almost collapsed, really. It was shock, screaming. And that's when I knew Adam told Mother. Quite depressing at the time.
Sadly, yours is an ordeal that other people will have to go through.
Yes.
What do you think are the lessons that you could give them from your experience of how to cope with someone close to you getting this disease?
Mine, I think we have to first love this person, what is nearest to us, as one of the beloved and family, and care for them, not cast them as one of them. We have to show them love, respect, not blame them for anything what happened, because that's never return anything, you know?
When Mrs. Shotko's son Adam died of AIDS, it was largely regarded as a disease of homosexual men.
Oh, so sad, but at the same time, incredibly brave and courageous of Adam to speak out despite the concerns he shared of the stigma that he feared for his family and what they would face. And, he was putting them first when he's the one living with the condition and really should have been putting himself first. And then for his mother and brother to speak so publicly on camera, you would hope that, their appearances would soften the rhetoric and the stigma around HIV and AIDS. And it's just truly, truly courageous. So brave.
It's going to be a battle, but I'm prepared to take it. Life is a battle.
Now, if you've tuned into previous episodes of AIDS The Lost Voices, and I hope you have, you may recall from the Series 1 finale, Serving 10, Norman Redman, that we mentioned a young man named Andrew Blythe who'd gone off from Brighton to Paris for the experimental HIV/AIDS treatment HPA23, and he was cited in one of the tabloid's newspapers. And in that episode, I was having trouble learning more about what happened to Andrew next. So as a bit of a reminder, let's just take a listen. Here we go.
The headline reads, AIDS Seaside Shocker, with the strap line, alert as killer plague takes hold on Brighton.
The latest known Brighton AIDS victim is hotelier Andrew Blythe. He has sold up and gone to Paris for, quote, guinea pig tests with a new drug, HPA-23, the same one used on film star Rock Hudson, who died in October.
I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like in their shoes during this time.
You mean Andrew Blyven going off for the treatment in Paris?
Yeah.
No, neither can I, and I live with the disease. And when I hear some of the prima donnas today that are living with HIV that complain, oh, I have to take one, two, or, you know, three or four pills a day, and, oh, I want to end my life, and it's so dramatic, I think, fucking hell, wake up. You've got the privilege of effective treatment that keeps your HIV virus low. It keeps it down to undetectable levels. So how they have the gall when so many men and women from this time would have no doubt have given anything, absolutely anything, to be able to just pop a few pills and live a normal, healthy life with a normal life expectancy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can't put myself in the shoes of people like Andrew Blythe that's having to sell up his business to go to Paris to try an experimental drug.
And was this HPA-23 effective?
Well, in short, no. In the end, they did find, when they'd done extensive trials on the drug, that it absolutely had no effect on HIV/AIDS whatsoever. So the drug did nothing, I'm afraid.
What happened to Andrew Blythe once he sold up and left Brighton?
Well, I'm not one to give up because I can find absolutely no trace of Andrew Blythe. I couldn't find anything even in the electoral records in Brighton. I mean, it was a bit of a soft search, but I couldn't find anything. And normally I can come up with people quite quickly. I checked the records in Paris and in France. I've looked at the records over here. It's quite a common name. It's quite popular. So I may have looked and had sight of the Andrew Blythe, but perhaps not being able to put two and two together to work out that that's the one I'm looking for. But I will stick at it. I will keep at it because I'm so invested to know what happened next for Andrew Blythe. So I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Okay.
So that was Andrew Blythe being mentioned in a much wider article in the Sunday Mirror on the 15th of December, 1985. But we didn't need the Sunday Mirror to tell us that Andrew had gone to Paris because 13 days earlier, Andrew Blythe himself had featured in BBC's Panorama programme. So let's take a listen.
Paris has attracted the last hopes of many AIDS victims. Andrew Blythe, who comes from Brighton, is here to be treated with the same French drug, HPA-23, that Rock Hudson tried. Andrew originally came to Paris earlier this year with his lover, who has since died of AIDS. They felt that not enough was done for them in England.
My friend had been ill for about 2 months already, and then shortly after we arrived in Paris, I began to have breathing problems, and I guessed really what it was, and so they took me very seriously at the American hospital, and they admitted us both together. We had a double room. And it was very hard to appreciate at that point that I was, in practice, as sick as my friend, because essentially he seemed much, much more severely ill than I was. He was incontinent, he was immobile, he had brain complications. And so really it was just a question of good nursing and making him as comfortable as possible. And bizarrely, he actually died on the day I began my therapy at St. Petrea Hospital.
Every day, Andrew crosses Paris to get an injection of HPA-23 at a hospital clinic. Doctors at the hospital accept that their drug has toxic side effects and that there are no conclusive, optimistic results. But for patients like Andrew, there seems no choice but to go on with what may be a risky treatment.
Do you feel any doubts about being a guinea pig, as it were, for experimental treatment?
Not at all, and it irritates me that some scientists and doctors criticise individual research programmes and say that such and such might be a cancer-causing agent, when it's completely irrelevant. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to die of cancer in 10 years' time instead of dying of AIDS in a couple of weeks' time or a month's time. So that doesn't concern me at all.
Do you think that having been so close to somebody who did die has made you more frightened or less frightened of what may happen to you?
Less frightened, definitely. I'm not frightened of dying anyway. I'm just frightened of becoming incapable, incontinent, unable to make intelligent decisions. That frightens me very much, but I'm not frightened of dying as such.
The French drug was developed at the world-famous Pasteur Institute. Here, scientists have found the answer to infections like diphtheria and rabies. Now they've taken on AIDS.
They may have taken on AIDS, but sadly without success. As we said in Norman Redmond's episode, HPA23 proved ineffective in bringing HIV under control. Some scientific papers I looked at said in many cases it proved to speed up HIV, turning it into an AIDS diagnosis a lot quicker. But you can't knock them for trying. You know, they had a drug and they went with it. It didn't work. That's it. But at least they tried. Anyhow, back to Andrew, because I did find that Andrew Blythe did return to the United Kingdom, and he wasn't from Brighton, as the newspapers had cited. He was, in fact, born Andrew William Menzies Blythe of Lincoln, Lincolnshire. He was born on the 18th of April 1957 to parents William Henry Blythe and Eileen C. Menzies, who married the year prior to his birth in 1956. Now, Andrew being cited in the Sunday Mirror wasn't his first media appearance, because Andrew, aged 22, appeared in the Lincolnshire Echo on the 19th of March 1980 under the headline, "Obtained Clothes by Deception," and the article reads, "A man obtained clothes from a Lincoln boutique and then went abroad without paying for them. Andrew William Menzies Blythe, 22, of no fixed address, pleaded guilty to obtaining by deception clothing to the value of £75 from Square One Shop at High Street, Lincoln. The hearing was adjourned until April 8th for reports. Blythe was granted £500 bail on condition that he lives with his mother on Cross Oak Cliff Hill, reports to police twice a day, and surrenders his passport." Seems a bit excessive. Mr. Dick Marshall, prosecuting, said the offence was committed in 1976, but Blythe was arrested only last week when he returned to England from Canada. From October 1975, Blythe had a credit account with the shop. He paid £6 a month by banker's order. The payment ceased in May 1976, but in the July, Blythe visited the shop, paid the balance, and asked for the arrangement to continue, Mr. Marshall said. Blythe obtained clothes costing £75, but left the area shortly afterwards without making any payments. In mitigation, Mr. David Ford said it was an old offence of which Blythe had very little recollection. He had left the country to see the world, not to avoid anything. Oh, you got to love a local story and a local rag. They don't half make it sound like it's the crime of the century, but I can't help but feel that Andrew's plea is more to acknowledge the receipt of the goods on credit rather than a full admission of guilt, hinting to an oversight rather than a deliberate wrongdoing. And the article notes that Andrew has just returned to England from a globe-trotting adventure in Canada, raising questions about the privileges of travel experienced by those his age, which at the late 70s, you know, he'd have been 20, 21 when he went off travelling. So you could speculate whether settling a clothing account was a priority for him, weighed against the allure of exploration, you know, going around and travelling the globe. Whether it was deliberate or not, we will never know, but I think, personally, it was just an oversight. Anyhow, the next time we see Andrew in the press is in January 1984, and he's now in Brighton. And the national newspaper The Observer, on the 22nd of January 1984, in a classified advert under the heading Furnishing, reads, "Andrew Blythe Design will carefully plan and carry out the design of your entire home or simply one room, creating a breathtaking result within a reasonable budget. All major credit cards accepted. Please telephone 0273, which was an old Brighton dialing code, or write to Andrew Blythe Design, Oxford House, 8 Pool Valley, Brighton." Now, I know Gloria calls me the Jessica Fletcher, but I am very much amateur sleuth. But it is amazing when you're researching somebody that this one tiny, minuscule classified advert amongst hundreds of other adverts in the Observer newspaper really does lay out the path that Andrew took. So in 1984, he is at, or he's got connections with, Oxford House, which was a guest house in Brighton for over 100 years. It was a long-established guest house in 8 Pool Valley, just set back from the Brighton seafront. I think now it's Google Street View shows that it's an abandoned takeaway. But I believe right up until the early 2000s, it was still a hotel, bed and breakfast, guest house. And the significance of this connection was highlighted in the Sunday Mirror on the 15th of December 1985, when they did a full-page spread on the AIDS crisis that was unfolding in Brighton. and where Andrew Blythe was mentioned in the article as going off to Paris for the HPA 23 experimental treatment, and he'd sold up the guest house. Now, I don't think this guest house, Oxford House, was Andrew's business. I could be wrong. I have a feeling it's more his friend and lover, who was Edward Eddie Buckley. And the adverts don't end there, because throughout the whole of 1984, there was regular adverts placed in the local newspapers of Chelsea, London. Just for example, in the Westminster and Pimlico News on the 25th of May 1984, we now see an advert with a large locomotive steam train, very classy, very elegant, very art deco, with a sign that says, "The Chelsea Express Decorating Company." And the advert reads, "Fine paintwork, wall coverings, curtains and blinds from conception to completion in only 10 days. Fabrics and papers of all major houses can be arranged. Interior design advice, if required. All major credit cards accepted. For prompt attention, please telephone Andrew Blythe on 01404 5011. And then I found myself researching this telephone number, and I found, oh, I want to say trillions of adverts with this telephone number on for other businesses, but the main one was, this was a business that I believe had been going from around 1925, that was a post handling service, but it was also, this telephone number was also a telephone answering service. So it seems possibly that Andrew hasn't got roots in London, because some of the other adverts that follow on after also have the Brighton dialing code, which would perhaps suggest that Andrew is based in Brighton with his friend and lover Eddie at the guest house. And by placing adverts in Chelsea and Westminster, he's perhaps tapping into the rich clientele who are going to use his decorating or interior design services. And we also find that his business is featured in the Westminster and Pimlico News on the 8th of June 1984. And the feature states, "A lovely room," right, because there's a photograph of a very nicely decorated room. "A lovely room," right, "decorated by the Chelsea Express Decorating Company, which offer a first-class decorating, curtain and blind-making service. The advisory service is only offered when asked for by a customer, and they will gladly carry out any scheme of a customer's choice. In this way, with the emphasis on the decorating rather than on the design, they hope to reach a whole new clientele who might otherwise have been intimidated by the very notion of approaching an interior designer themselves. The Chelsea Express Decorating Company may be reached on 01404, that London number, or 0273, that landline in Brighton." And so it seems through the newspaper archives that Andrew was very busy in 1984 promoting his business, the Chelsea Express Decorating Company. And as we know, in 1985, Andrew and his partner, Eddie Buckley, leave Brighton and they go off to Paris for the experimental treatment in HPA 23. And as Andrew shared in this interview to BBC's Panorama, sadly his friend and partner, lover, passes away. And Andrew remains in Paris and continues his treatment in HPA 23. And then this brings us back to when we first came across Andrew Blythe in episode 10. What happened to Andrew next? Well, there was no follow-up in any of the newspapers. There was nothing from the BBC or the Panorama team. However, we did learn that Andrew did return to England. He did return to London because, sadly, his body was found on the 4th of December 1986 in his basement flat at Addison Gardens in the London borough of Hammersmith and Fulham. Andrew William Menzies Blythe died at the age of 29. His death certificate lists his occupation as unemployed interior designer, perhaps alluding that he'd fallen unwell and was unable to work for a period before he sadly passed away. There is no informant on the death certificate given the manner in which his body was found. His death was subject to an inquest, which was held the following year on the 16th of April 1987. Now, I spent hours searching the newspaper archives for any insight into the discussions that took place during the inquest, and perhaps that would hint to how Andrew was found and sadly passed away, but I couldn't find anything. Especially as we knew Andrew was living with HIV/AIDS, I thought there had to be something. The press would never miss an opportunity to stigmatise the condition or the individual, or even vilify the individual, but I couldn't find anything. However, I think the cause of death recorded by the inquest tells us everything that we need to know, because the cause of death upon the death certificate states, "Unascertained, found at home, open verdict." Now, if you're listening to this episode for the first time, you might think, well, this gentleman was found at home, they haven't been able to ascertain what the cause of death was, therefore it's an open verdict. It's not unusual, it happens to many people. However, If you've listened to some of our episodes before, you will perhaps, like me, start to see a pattern emerging. And it's not even just us. It was widely reported in the press because at the time, during the 1980s, pathologists, pathology staff, mortuary staff, refused to carry out a post-mortem, an internal examination. I don't think I need to go into any more detail than that. To carry out a post-mortem because they had this irrational fear that they were going to contract HIV or AIDS just from doing so. And this was despite many top authorities telling them that there was no risk of catching HIV/AIDS through carrying out an internal exam on a deceased if they wore the relevant PPE. It's just it's as simple as that. And, you know, you got Edward Cairns. Remember Edward Cairns, the artist? His death was ruled as not ascertained, found at home, open verdict. We had the gentleman from Soho, Michael John Bedford. Remember, there were a couple, or believed to be a couple. His death was ruled as not ascertained, found at home, open verdict. Remember as well, in the Michael John Bedford case, the coroner, Dr. Nachman, was furious that they were being denied these post-mortems because he said it's a vital part of establishing the cause of death, which could essentially rule out foul play. And some people may argue, you know, is it really relevant to have the cause of death? And I suppose it's really on an individual basis. And I think here in Andrew's case, it would be somewhat that the family would only be able to answer. But I think for me, you know, 2 years after Andrew died, my father passed away in 1988, and he was heterosexual. He wasn't perceived to have HIV/AIDS, and therefore he was given a post-mortem without question to establish his cause of death. And I think the same should have been afforded to all these men, and I suspect it happened to many women as well, these men and women who had a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS or even merely suspected of having HIV/AIDS. I mean, I forgot to mention earlier, Stuart Thompson Neal, he was another young man that was suspected of having HIV and AIDS, wasn't confirmed, but he was denied a post-mortem, and that was one of the big articles that kicked off at the time. But, you know, I think we can only take comfort for the fact that Andrew's suffering perhaps wasn't long and drawn out, and he himself said that
I'm not frightened of dying anyway. I'm just frightened of becoming incapable, incontinent, unable to make intelligent decisions. That frightens me very much, but I'm not frightened of dying as such.
This next man, like Adam Shotcore that we heard from earlier, had also been admitted to the isolation ward at Ham Green Hospital and had agreed to be filmed for Thames TV and their TVI series. He is 37-year-old William Ayres, better known as Bill, and he told Thames TV in an interview how he came to be admitted.
We're going to join Khalid Aziz, who's talking to Bill Ayres, a computer engineer aged 37 who has AIDS.
The word AIDS start to enter your thinking.
I first of all just thought I had the flu and refused outright to allow any doctor in the place because I've never even taken aspirin. And I had a bath and nearly fell over and nearly killed myself. And at that point I said, call the doctor because, you know, I'm ill and I don't know what's happening. And as I was talking to the doctor, I informed him that the symptoms are telling me I've got W-pneumonia, and with all the other symptoms, it's painfully obvious I've probably got AIDS.
When you were admitted to hospital, how were you treated there by the staff?
Their concern was written on their face, and they treated me with as much kindness relative to their knowledge.
Did you get the sense that they were worried or panicky about the fact that you
panicking.
Might have AIDS?
No, they were totally panicking. As much as I was, they were as panicking as much as I was. And their panic, in some respects, probably made things a little worse for me. I mean, I was very ill. I couldn't stay awake for more than 10 minutes. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move. In reality, I thought I was going to die. But as I understand it, I will never be cured of anything. They can, with the use of modern drugs, keep it under control. I am still on very large doses of antibiotics for the pneumonia.
When it was finally confirmed officially that you did have AIDS, what was your reaction?
The nightmare was when I was told I had AIDS when I was in Bath, which was before Christmas, probably nearly a month before. I'm sorry if I'm vague there because the past to me is now totally irrelevant. The future is the only thing which is important to me. And I probably have got these times slightly mixed up, but to me, it's incredibly unimportant. When I was told I had AIDS there, I thought I was going to die, and that was it. It was a nightmare for me, obviously, I think, like anybody. And I laid there and I thought, well, goodbye, cruel world. I mean, that's all I thought, and said, well, you've played hard, lived hard for 37 damn years. Just sad, that's all I thought of. Nothing, really. I'm dying. And that's all I thought of, nothing else.
And, just like Adam Shotcott, Bill Ayres also agreed to participate in the Thames TV TVI documentary, which based itself around Bristol and Ham Green Hospital and started recording it at the start of February 1985. Bill also agreed, courageously, to waive his anonymity and allowed himself to be identified in the documentary. This led to a series of newspaper articles, and just as filming started, the Daily Mirror on its front page on the 8th of February 1985 ran the headline "Heartbreak Plea of AIDS Victim" and was a story featuring Bill's AIDS diagnosis. And on the same day, 8th of February 1985, Bill's local newspaper, the Western Daily, also ran the headline alongside a photograph of Bill, "Help Me, I'm Going to Die of AIDS," which also reports on his appearance on Thames TV's daytime programme, to which we just heard Bill being interviewed. And as filming for TVI concluded mid to late February 1985, Bill again featured in many newspapers up and down the country, from his participation at the Thames TV headquarters and a news conference they gave ahead of the show, airing on the 28th of February 1985. The Western Daily on the same day ran the headline alongside a photograph of Bill, "I'm No Threat" by AIDS victim, with the strapline, "Don't panic, Westman tells the public," and it reads, "AIDS victim Bill Ayres said yesterday he was in more danger from the public than they were from him. He said the public should not panic about the disease. AIDS sufferers were no threat to them." Ayres, who believes he has a life expectancy of 12 months, also criticised the medical profession and the health department for their handling of information and treatment about the disease. Mr Ayres, aged 37, a former nightclub owner from Bath, will be seen on ITV tonight in a special TVI programme on the disease. Speaking at a news conference at Thames Television, which makes TVI, he said, "The press report the facts but leave the impression that AIDS is a plague. My message to the public is that they won't suffer any problems through AIDS and they shouldn't believe the impression given by the press." He told newsmen, "You and the public are all a great threat to me because you are carrying around funny little viruses that you fight naturally every day but can cause a lot of trouble for me. Those little viruses will eventually take me apart. I am not a danger to the public. I have consulted free top consultants in this field and that is what they tell me. But that hasn't been put over very well so far." Mr. Ayres said the distribution and dissemination of information about the disease was, quote, "appalling. It's like living in the dark ages." Mr. Ayres, a homosexual, did not think many of his sexual partners had been traced by the authorities, although they said they would be.
Bill Ayres has been out of hospital for over a month, and he's finding society suspicious, mistrustful, and more than a little frightened of him. He's at home with his lover because his doctor believes that providing he doesn't have sexual intercourse, he poses no threat.
The feeling that I had when the doctors confirmed that I had AIDS was, in some respects, a nothing feeling that I already knew, in a sense. They just confirmed what I already knew. I was just frightened, would be the best way. I thought, well, right, you know, you're on your way out, Billy.
Do you get depressed?
Depressed, yes. Yes. Yes, like I think almost anybody would. It's not to do with AIDS. It's to do with the fact that I'm terminal. It's to do with the fact that I've been told that I've probably got not that long. And obviously there are things that I might vaguely regret, and there are things that I would like to do in the future which I won't be able to achieve. So of course I get depressed as much as anybody else would who was told that they didn't have very much longer to go.
Are you frightened?
Of course. Paranoid.
Victims like Bill Ayres have to be careful about catching the slightest infection. That's because Bill won't die of AIDS itself, but some other illness. AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, means that his body has lost the ability to defend itself. Even a common cold could prove fatal. Although at the moment, red marks on his face, fungal infection, are the only obvious sign. Dr. Stuart Glover of Ham Green Hospital near Bristol had to tell Bill Ayres that he had AIDS.
He took this in his stride. He kept any immediate anxiety to himself.
Did you indicate to him that AIDS, on past records, is a fatal disease for which there is no cure?
We discussed this, yet we also discussed the positive approach to his illness. Statistically, the odds are not good. However, one must never deprive any patient of hope.
But what are the facts about people who get AIDS?
The facts are stark. The chaps who have the full-blown syndrome, such as Mr. Ayres, perhaps have a life expectancy of 6 to 8 months. All right?
Good.
Well, let me just examine the glands in your neck. Have you had any discomfort in the neck recently?
No, I haven't.
Not at all. Good. And that's very encouraging. I can't feel any swollen lymph nodes there. If I may have a look inside...
Dr. Glover has had 6 AIDS patients. 3 have already died.
That's
grand. And again.
Are there potentially others than your lover who could be at risk?
Oh, I feel sure that there could be. I don't know would be the answer to that question. If, as I understand it, the disease can stay in the body and not manifest itself in any illness for as long as 4 years, as I understand it, then obviously that's the truth, yes.
Many others?
Yes, I've always been a relatively well-adjusted gay. Show me one who's not.
What does that
reasonably
mean?
Promiscuous. I mean, I am a gay person, and yes, I have sex with other people because it's part of our culture.
Do you still have sex with anybody?
I haven't had sex with anybody. I'm not really quite sure. It's probably 15 months. I've always been well aware of my body and what's going on, and if I wouldn't have sex with it, then I don't expect anybody else to have sex with it.
The end of the day, and Bill, now 37, marks the passing of another milestone with an entry in his diary. At least Bill, as he himself admits, knew the risks and took his chances. But for Bill Ayres and 80 other AIDS sufferers in this country, it's not the end of this year, let alone the end of next, that matters. There's a fair chance they won't be around to see either. It's today, the present. How are they to cope with a world which suddenly sees them as a threat when they themselves are uncertain as to whether they're a threat or not?
It's a nightmare to me to think that I might be a threat in that sense. Doctors have informed me that I'm not, but I got the inkling that maybe I am. So it doesn't make for good relationships with one's friends. It doesn't make for good relationships with one's lover or anything, or parents or anybody, with the kind of reporting which is going on at the moment, or the dissemination of information. It doesn't help the situation in any sense. If I am a threat, fine, say so, and let's get on with the job of trying to solve the problem. But if I'm not a threat, then please, let's make life at least reasonably tolerable to allay the fears of the people who are close to me and who want to be close to me.
So, how much of a threat is AIDS to the general public? How contagious is the disease? Dr. Stuart Glover.
This is not a contagion. This is not a disease such as the plague, which is spread by contact. It's not like smallpox, which could waft through the atmosphere and the virus could survive out with the human body. This is a very fastidious virus. It likes to be inside the human body at 37 degrees centigrade, body temperature. It likes even more so to be inside a particular group of cells in the human body and is only transmitted between two intimately contacted human bodies. I think the public have been led to believe, misled even, that this is something that is spread by very, very social contact. This is not so.
Bill Ayres has started going out and about again, but it hasn't been easy. When he went to one restaurant in Bath, the restaurant asked TBI not to mention the fact. Now he's taking up gardening. Denied the ability to work, the allotment behind his house will give him a new interest. He used to be a nightclub owner until he began to feel ill. At Christmas, his doctor told him he had AIDS.
My lucky day today.
Like others facing death through illness, it's a situation which means coping with the unconscious ironies of everyday life.
And you like Percy Thrush? You get stuck.
I've heard about him. He's on that programme on Radio 4, isn't he?
He's actually very ill at the moment. Have you heard that?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah. He's the greatest expert, and he had a small stroke last week, and we all hope he's going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
So you read that.
And amongst the plants he bought was one called Bristol Fairies.
Priceless Bristol Fairies. Do you know what a Bristol Fairy does for your garden?
Hopefully make it look pretty.
Yes, and it's very good for cut flowers and cut flower arrangements. And now we'll add them up. Well, we've already added a good deal.
Bill Ayres hopes that future AIDS victims and their families will have more precise answers to questions about what they can and can't do than when he first got the disease.
My mother, when she was nursing me when I came out of hospital, had no help from the social services in any sense. They didn't know what she should wash and what she should touch and what she shouldn't. She had to pray and hope that the information I gave her, and at times I was very ill, was correct. All the way through, everybody who comes into contact with you are, A, they're fearful, and I don't blame them, the information they receive, and B, when they try to find out information, the answers are evasive.
This morning, Bill Ayres arrived in London. There was a problem with hotels. Several refused him because of AIDS. But the meeting with Junior Health Minister John Paton went ahead.
I think we should be trying to do more to give help and advice to those people who are going to look after people who've contracted AIDS.
In some sense. Yeah, there's a problem there. They're petrified.
Yeah.
I mean, the newspaper reports make them petrified.
Of course.
Logical. Why shouldn't they?
Mm. Well, as far as information's concerned, we've given information to all the hospitals and to all the regional health authorities, as we were saying a minute ago. We're going to be writing to every GP in the country, and GPs are to a certain extent in the front line, within the next few weeks, giving them more advice.
When I was in hospital, nobody approached me. I wasn't asked, in any sense, if they could help me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had to ask them to help me, you know, in a real sense. And if you're terminal or if you're very ill, that is normally taken over for you. Whereas in this case of AIDS, it doesn't actually work because people are fearful, therefore they avoid the situation like the plague.
Well, that's that dreaded word again.
I've found out by the grapevine that the majority of surgeons would not perform routine operations on a person such as myself. Like, if I had appendicitis, the chances of me getting the operation are quite remote and I'll probably fade away because of the appendicitis. Now, that's quite frightening.
Well, that again is something that needs to be thought about, but let me stress that, that there hasn't been a case like that which you've just suggested might happen.
No.
The minister and the AIDS victim, a public show of confidence in a world of private uncertainty.
After Bill's story aired on Thames Television's TVI programme, the tabloid started knocking. One of those Bill spoke to was the Daily Mirror on the 5th of March 1985. The article is full of quotes from Bill, answering what seemed to be intrusive questions, but I get the feeling the journalist, if you can call them that, had perhaps met their match in Bill, as part of the article state, quote, "He knows how he caught the disease, through promiscuity, yet, although he has perhaps only 10 months to live, he is unrepentant." Oh, gosh. I mean, what's he got to repent for? Anyhow, Bill is quoted in saying when he responds, "I've led what you call a fast life. So what?" Hear, hear, Bill. I like Bill because he's just straight talking. And what I truly admire in this interview that Bill's given to the Daily Mirror in regards to his no-nonsense, straight-talking approach is that Bill gives a very interesting perspective that I know to be true today, despite so many young people who have latched onto the gay community that believe they're still fighting for equality for gay men and women, always spout that there was an incredible amount of, quote, community spirit when it came to the AIDS pandemic. And to a degree, there was, you know, I'm not disputing that. But they never talk about, all too often, gay men at the time, and more so today with gay men who wield PrEP pills like a carton of Tic Tacs, like their heterosexual counterparts, stigmatise and stigmatised those with an HIV and AIDS diagnosis. They avoided them, well, like the plague. Tell me what gay man in the 80s and 90s, equally, if not more so, wanted to continue enjoying themselves but didn't want to become infected with HIV/AIDS? Just think about it. And while Bill holds himself well in his interviews, you can tell by the tone that he has a direct point of view, and he isn't afraid to call out his fellow gays, as he does in the interview with the Daily Mirror, where the article continues. Fellow gays, Bill admits, are almost frenzied in their reaction to his illness. Quote, they know they can only get this disease by intimate contact, but they become hysterical when they are in groups. Some can't bear to be in the same room with me. To give context, in recent times, it would have been interesting to see how much more stigma gay men would have applied to other gay men had there not been an effective vaccine or treatment for monkeypox. On the ground, there was so much stigma equal to HIV/AIDS, although not a death sentence. Someone who became infected with monkeypox was immediately outed with visual boils, blisters and scars, especially in an age where many rely on their perceived good looks. Even I heard a lot of gossiping from my gay friends, you know, of who they were going to avoid because they thought they were a bit of a slut and were going to catch monkeypox, and it was so infectious. So, you know, to say that this didn't happen during the AIDS pandemic, even on the testimony of Bill Ayres there in that interview, that gay men were not part of the problem in regards to HIV/AIDS stigma, often laid solely with heterosexuals, is disingenuous and totally selective. Anyhow, 8 months later, Bill was interviewed again by Thames TV for TVI AIDS and You, which aired on ITV on the 7th of October 1985. The camera films Bill at home, and he looks visibly more gaunt than he had done previously. For a man who was 37, he could easily be mistaken for being in his 50s. A handsome 50s, but still, he looks a lot older than he actually is. But he remains optimistically upbeat.
An autumn morning in the Royal Crescent at Bath. Home of the first British AIDS sufferer who allowed himself to be identified on television. 9 months ago, Bill Ayres appeared on TVI, shortly after he'd been told that he was suffering from AIDS. He said then that he didn't know how long he had to live. Today, he's still trying to come to terms with an incurable disease.
Well, generally, I've been improving. Most of the problems which I had 8 months ago seem to have cleared up and disappeared. Psychologically, I've been up and down like a yo-yo, trying to come to terms with everything around me. I would argue that, and have argued, I think, since the last programme, that I think you can make yourself better, and that, in fact, the disease itself is handleable. But unfortunately, the medical profession, everything else around you, well, for me anyway, have never given me really that kind of encouragement. So I found that very difficult. But generally, I'm okay, I'm fine. I feel it anyway.
Bill caught AIDS through homosexual intercourse. The virus infected him, and in his case, the disease developed.
Oh, of course Bill caught it through homosexual intercourse. That's the only way you can catch it, obviously. Oh, gosh. It's not, I'm being facetious, because while you can credit Thames TV in 1985 for reporting on AIDS and giving Bill, Adam and many others an opportunity to give their own experience and perspective on living with the disease, some of the questioning and narration is similar to that of the tabloids. I mean, for example, had the reporter merely signed off with Bill caught AIDS through intercourse, I suspect those that tuned in who weren't gear would have taken note and said, it could happen to me too. I mean, one very good question Thames TV put to Bill was,
what do you feel about the approach of the state towards your problem?
Well, there isn't any approach by the state, is there? And the state is not interested. It's shown no interest. I mean, it waffles, but it shows no interest whatsoever, does it?
In what way?
Well, it's given us, I think, a derisory $250,000 for research into a problem which is so painfully obvious that if you added a naught or two noughts to it, you might possibly be coming somewhere near solving the problem.
Do you understand the public fears that there are about AIDS?
Of course. They know nothing. The state makes a dog's breakfast of everything it says about it, so it's not really surprising that they react and are scared out of their box. So am I.
But you have sympathy for people who are frightened about coming into contact with people like you.
Absolutely. I, in fact, have since found out, by the way, not informed, but found out that it is not as contagious as the officials seem to indicate. And, of course, that is then reflected in the nightmare headlines in the gutter press.
Why have you decided to talk about the fact that you've got AIDS now?
Well, I'm going to die. I don't want to die. And nothing really is being done. The government has made a derisory offer of money, or given a derisory... It won't even pay for the office space and a secretary and a few typewriters. I'm a taxpayer. Lots of homosexuals, we're all taxpayers. We contribute to society in greater and lesser extents, and I'm sorry, it's totally inadequate and it's absurd. And it's selfish. I want something done. I don't want to die.
Bill Ayres, and thank you for talking to us, Bill. John Patton, he didn't mince his words. The dog's breakfast, he said, there's no approach by the state, no government initiative. Government doesn't really care. No interest, no nothing.
Well, I can understand Mr. Ayres' state of mind, and I can understand his feelings, and I sympathise with him very much. However, we, just as much as Mr. Ayres, want desperately to be in a position to say, yes, we can identify in carriers of the virus itself, a virus that was only discovered some 9 months ago, categorically discovered some 9 months ago. We want desperately to be able to say, yes, we can find a cure. That's why we're backing research. It's not a matter of just being able to say, well, look, give us the money and we'll be able to provide the cure. We
can
only go as fast as medical science
will
take us.
The money is going into research, yes, but he is at grassroots level with AIDS, with perhaps 18 months, maybe 8 weeks to live. There's no money ploughed into the hospitals, to the dentist who say he's going to get his teeth done. Nobody seems to know what to do.
No, every conceivable medical aid and help is given to any homosexual, any heterosexual for that matter, who suffers from AIDS. And there are about 60 or 70 at present in this country, apart from those who unfortunately and tragically have died over the last 3 or 4 years. No one's being denied the necessary medical help that they need to ameliorate the symptoms and to make their period of illness and perhaps tragically into the run-up to their death as easy as possible. But what we do not have is a cure.
And Bill was spot on.
And the state waffles, but it shows no interest whatsoever, does it?
I thought was pure class in how Bill summed up the government's response to the AIDS pandemic. The UK government did nothing but diver and delay when it came to AIDS coming to the UK. But you can't say the presenter there, Sarah Kennedy, didn't try and hold that junior minister to account. And as she signed off her show on the 7th of February 1985, she gave the last word to Bill.
Well, that's all for today. Goodbye from us at daytime. And let's leave the last words now to a very brave man, Mr. Bill Ayres.
I'm glad that I wake up in the morning and I try to live for the moment and the future and not for the past. I have a little bit of nostalgia here and there, but I try to enjoy what I've got, my friends and relations and just enjoy life, which is the only thing I really can do now, as best I can anyway.
This next voice you will hear is of a young man who appeared in the same BBC Panorama programme as Andrew Blythe, which aired on the 2nd of December 1985. It starts with footage of him on a ladder, painting a doorway in his flat with the radio playing in the background.
In West London, Chris Gresham, who was recently diagnosed with AIDS, now lives by himself. AIDS has shocked him into celibacy. At the moment, he feels well enough to paint his flat. He was only 19 when he suffered the first debilitating symptoms.
I was fatigued, also considerable weight loss. I was nearly 9 stone, and I'd gone down to 7 stone. It was a gradual thing, so I didn't really notice it until I actually got on the scales. And also sort of night sweats all the time.
What are night sweats exactly?
Well, you'd go to sleep at night, and as I'm sort of dozing off, my body temperature would rise, and by morning time, the sleep was irregular, you would sort of wake up. By morning time, sometimes the bed would be drenched, sopping wet. Recently, I was very scared when I was in hospital. The fear did hit me, and you're sort of not about your wits. You're sort of a different person. So it isn't reason. It's not rational. It's just.
But were
anxiety.
You scared of pain or suffering or death? Or...
No, I've experienced quite a lot of pain, and I'm not afraid of pain. I can't put my finger on it. It must be just afraid of the unknown, afraid that I was dying.
In trying to find out more about Chris Gresham, I too stumbled across an unknown, because there was absolutely no record of a Chris or Christopher Gresham who would have fallen into the age range of this man here in the UK. I spent hours checking and double checking, and while I knew my research was solid, I felt I'd missed something. And then, just by chance, as I'm not a user of Facebook, but I have an account solely for researching those that survive the individuals that we've covered in previous episodes, I was a member of a Facebook group where so many men come together to reminisce in the London gay scene from the 1980s and 90s. So I posted a screenshot from this Panorama programme, and I said I was wanting to learn more about this man and that his name may not have been Chris Gresham, and it was, you know, it could be perhaps a switch of his surname or a mother's maiden name. But ultimately, did anybody recognise this man in the image? And it can't have been more than an hour when a chap called David not only responded with a black and white photograph of this young man, but he also wrote, his name was Joe, and he passed away in 1987. He lived just off Ladbroke Grove and was a practising Buddhist. His close friend was Philip Langridge, also a Buddhist. He passed away in 1991 and was commemorated on the AIDS quilt. He, Joe, didn't want to talk about his family in the United States and what had happened to him there. For me, both he and Philip showed such a positive attitude of life, which was a real contrast to the fear and stigma prevalent at the time when people with HIV or a diagnosis of AIDS were supposed to be miserable, sick, and waiting to die. They attributed this to their Buddhist practice. Joe showed me some photos from when he was younger and chubby. He gave me the photo above so that I would remember him looking happy, as he knew his time was limited. He was a vibrant young man, had a wicked sense of humour, and was a lot of fun. I remember him and Philip because they showed me a different way of understanding HIV/AIDS. They were so compassionate to others, and they brought the best out of so many people around them.
One of the most common infections, which is often fatal, is a particularly severe form of pneumonia called pneumocystis.
I was couldn't breathe. I found it very difficult to breathe. I had gone into hospital earlier to speak to my doctor about it, and he confirmed then that I had pneumonia, and he didn't know what type of pneumonia, though. So he put me on antibiotics. They were the wrong sort. So within a couple of days, my condition had gone worse, and I was actually collapsed, and I rang a friend up to sort of come and get me and take me to hospital.
Most AIDS victims die within 2 years of one infection or another.
And then, from the amazing response on the appeal that we placed on the Facebook group, mainly this young man's friend David, who confirmed that his name was not Chris Gresham, but his name was Joe. And after a little bit of research, we found out that this young man is Joseph Wade Walker, Now, he was born on the 3rd of December 1963 in Waco, Texas, to parents Max Hansford Walker and Susan Phyllis McGuire, as was several of Joe's other siblings, but mainly his twin brother, identical twin brother, David. In a bid to learn more about Joe's early life and possibly what brought him to London, we turned to Joe's surviving family and the newspaper archives over in the United States. Now, we couldn't find anything specific on Joe, but we did establish that Joe's parents hailed from Kentucky, but spent a significant part of their lives in Texas, where Joe was born, before settling back in Louisville. They raised Joe alongside his twin brother David and their siblings Michelle and Raymond, with all four children attending Doss High School, a familiar institution that served as a backdrop for their formative years. Joe was last recorded at Doss High School in Louisville, Kentucky in 1979. It is believed he relocated to London shortly thereafter, possibly around 1980, though the exact timeline remains unconfirmed. Joe's friend here in London, David, revealed Joe was reticent about the reasons for his departure from America. There was an unmistakable weight to his silence, suggesting that whatever prompted his move was both significant and deeply personal. Then in 1985, Joe, under the pseudonym Chris Gresham, gained notable attention when he appeared on BBC Panorama programme AIDS: The Race for a Cure, of which aired on the 2nd of December 1985.
Chris Gresham, who has been in hospital twice with pneumonia, now goes regularly to a specialist outpatient clinic in London. Dr. Charles Farthing takes frequent blood samples to check the spread of the virus and to monitor the state of his immune system. The doctor has urged him to try a new experimental drug. It's called Foscarnet, is made in Sweden, and has worked successfully against other viruses.
Well, we of course can't promise you that this is going to be a cure for AIDS, or necessarily have any great effect, but we feel it's essential, and obviously you do too, that we assess new drugs. We have noticed some side effects, or the where the drug has been used elsewhere.
Doctors have to balance the need to test the new drugs against the risks to the patients. Farthing administers Foscarnet intravenously. Patients must stay in hospital for 3 weeks on a continuous drip. Some have experienced unpleasant side effects.
How does it sound after those side effects?
I'm optimistic. I want to do it. I want to do the drug trial. The problems about the headaches and the inflaming the veins, I think I can. I don't think it's going to bother me at all.
Well, they are relatively minor problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's. You've got to take some things like that.
Right.
Farthing is encouraged by the early results of his clinical trials, but scientists are still only groping towards something that can vanquish AIDS. Chris Gresham is a Buddhist. He draws strength from his faith and the disciplines of a ritual which he practices for several hours every day. His Buddhism has made his attitude to AIDS aggressively positive.
I think anything can be overcome. Anything. Any illness. There's many examples of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be AIDS or even cancer, you know. I know I have friends who have actually overcome serious illnesses. So why can't this one be? And if one believes that, I mean, it's very important to believe that. And whenever doubt starts creeping in, to fight that doubt and not to give in to it. That's very important. If you give in to the doubt, you lose.
Normally, I'd say having a belief in a faith to overcome an illness, whether it be, as Joe said, cancer or AIDS, to be not only hocus pocus, but perhaps burying your head in the sand. But, to put it simply, what else did Joe, Bill, and all the other men and women have in the 1980s, other than a belief, a faith, or a hope that your condition would improve? And I think considering that there was no effective treatment, Having a fearful belief or hope no doubt made life with an AIDS diagnosis perhaps just that little bit more bearable. 13 months later, Joe sadly passed away at the tender age of 23. A devastating loss marked by the presence of his close friend Philip Langridge, who also succumbed to AIDS in 1991. As Philip held Joe's hand in those final moments, he also went on to register the deaf, reflecting on Joe's career as a sound engineer, a title that suggests involvement in media or music. Joe's cause of death was recorded as malabsorption-related complications, indicative of the severe weight loss associated with the later stages of AIDS, where the body struggles to absorb essential nutrients. Joe's story is a poignant reminder of the personal toll of the epidemic during a time when understanding the treatment options were still in their infancy. Joe was survived by his parents and siblings, including his identical twin brother, David. While the loss of these men featured, along with many other men, women and children too, HIV/AIDS is undeniably tragic, their legacy endures despite being hidden away in the media archives. They each faced significant adversity yet exhibited tremendous courage and determination throughout their diagnosis. Honouring their memory alongside all those who endured similar stigma and vilification merely for contracting HIV/AIDS is essential. We should remember them fondly, drawing inspiration from the remarkable bravery they displayed in giving these so public interviews, despite what was an extremely challenging and hostile environment. Their lives, their stories, in their own words, serve as a testament to resilience in the face of hardship, reminding us of the importance of compassion and understanding in our society when it comes to HIV/AIDS, which is still needed even to this day.
I'm just frightened of becoming incapable, unable to make intelligent decisions. That frightens me very much, but I'm not frightened of dying as such.
I have a little bit of nostalgia here and there, but I try to just enjoy life, which is the only thing I really can do now, as best I can anyway.
And whenever doubt starts creeping in, to fight that doubt and not to give in to it, that's very important. If you give in to the doubt, you lose.
I have regrets of having a disease, obviously. But there is no regrets, really.
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love, oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.